I'm here this evening with Ellen Datlow. Actually, it's evening for me here in London, and it's afternoon for Ellen in New York, if you want to say hi to everyone.
Through the magic of Skype, we can communicate, and even we can see each other, you can't see us.
It's true, yeah, we can make faces at each other, and they'll have no idea.
You'll never know.
So, first of all, congratulations on your successful Kickstarter campaign. That was your first ever Kickstarter campaign?
Yes. Well, the first one I've done. I mean, I've sponsored a few. I've backed a few. Probably, I mean, I don't know if I'll ever do it again. It was, I'm glad I did it, and it was, you know, one shot, and I'm really pleased how it came out.
Because you not only made your goal, you made your first stretch goal as well, so.
Right. Yeah, I forgot about the stretch. I didn't even remember what it was called. I said, what's the next level? And what is it? Oh, yeah, it's a stretch,
stretch goal.
I said, I hadn't even expected that, so I was like, oh, what are we going to do with that? So yeah, we added an extra cent a word for the contributors.
Yeah, so this is the anthology Fearful Symmetries, which now will pay 7 cents a word?
Yes, up to 10,000 words.
Up to 10,000 words.
See if we pay more for that.
Excellent. You do a lot of anthology projects, so why don't we begin by talking about the one that you've got coming out pretty much right now, which is your Queen Victoria anthology?
Yes. We actually have two coming out now, but first one, Queen Victoria's Book of Spells with Terry Windling, is a book of gaslight fantasy that's kind of historical fantasy from around the Victorian times. That's not exactly steampunk, but there may be, you know, we might have a steampunk story in it. And that's coming out from Tor, and that's all original. And we're really looking forward to that. The cover is gorgeous if you can find it.
Yeah, we'll get the cover art up on the
And the other book is going to be a reprint ghosts and haunted houses story called Hauntings from Tachyon Press.
Okay, and it's a reprint from when? Or is it a reprint anthology?
It's from fairly recent ghost stories and hauntings in the last, you know, I forget when the oldest story is from, but pretty contemporary.
So it's a anthology of reprints as opposed to a reprint of an old anthology?
Yes, I'm sorry. That would be called a reissue.
Okay.
It was an old anthology. It's a royal reprint anthology. Oh,
okay.
Sorry, it didn't confuse.
Great. Tell us a little bit about how you put together an anthology. Like, for example, your Queen Victoria anthology, which is, like you said, it's all original, and that means these are stories that weren't published anywhere else. Can you tell people a little bit about the process you go through to put together an anthology like that?
Sure. For an original anthology like that, well, Terry and I both have people we've worked with before. We've done about eight or more original anthologies together that we've collaborated on. So we know that we work well together, and we have our own writers who are our favorite writers and people we've worked with before. And so we contact, you know, we figure out what guidelines we want for any anthology, and then we go to basically the writers who we think can do a good job in that particular topic, leaving room for word of mouth occasionally, although not completely open market. And so with any original anthology, we ask like a third more people than you actually need, because generally a third of the people drop out for one reason or another, or the story is not the right story. Queen Victoria, we actually got a few more than we needed that were really terrific, but we just could not fit them in. I mean, by the time the stories came in, it's like, yeah, it's really good, but we can't, you know, they can't publish such a big book. We just kind of have to turn these down. So that happens occasionally, too.
So,
but basically, you ask the people for the story, and then you, as the stories come in, you give people a deadline, and as the stories come in, you kind of see what you've got, and you kind of figure out if you're getting too much of a type of story, or too much particular point of view, and then you go back to the writer and say, if you haven't started your story yet, please don't do this, or don't do that, we've got too many of these. And so someone will say, oh no, I did one, and I was like, well, don't. I mean, it depends on how, if we have five of them ready, forget it. So it's like a wrangling. It's not just, you know, you're waiting for the stories to come in, but you're also wrangling the writers as it happens. It's only a problem if the publisher is expecting specific big names, and then you don't get those names, and you're kind of in trouble. Then you have a problem. But otherwise, you know, I expect people to drop out. You know, I may nag them. I mean, the thing is, you can't sit on someone's shoulder and say, why aren't you writing that story? You know, what if happens personally, or they just don't have an idea sometimes, or the story isn't what we're looking for. So you have to be prepared for that, and you have to ask for more people than you need, generally.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that in that respect, your job as editor begins before you're even editing.
Absolutely, sure. I mean, when I'm committed to buy a story, I will maybe go if the story is really good and I like it but it has problems, I will work with the author on it before I even commit to buying it, if it needs a lot of work.
Uh-huh.
But even if a story doesn't need a lot of work when I buy it, I will always give it a final line edit, a careful line edit, line by line edit, before I'm handing the manuscript into production to go over last things that we missed, mm-hmm. that the author and I missed. And that's not copy editing. That's a different process that I don't do, that sure. a copy editor does. But my job can include certain copy. I mean, if I notice something, a grammatical error or a misspelling, of course I'm going to fix it, or an inconsistency. But that's not my job as an editor.
Right. Let's talk about how you got into editing in the first place, because you're one of the most well-known editors in the science fiction and fantasy genre. When did your interest begin in this genre?
Well, I read science fiction and fantasy and horror as a child. I mean, I always read it. Uh-huh. I actually started in book publishing. People ask me, and I really can't answer. I do not know why I thought of getting into publishing.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how I figured out that there was such an industry, but obviously I did somehow in my 20s, after I got that. I graduated in English Lit, and I think the ideas of what I could do were work in a bookstore, work in a library, but I don't know where the idea of, wait a minute, I could work in book publishing, whatever that means.
Uh-huh.
I don't know where that idea came from. But when I traveled in Europe for a year and I got back and I applied for jobs as an editorial assistant, and I actually got a job as sales secretary at Little Brown & Company's New York office. And that's how I started. So I worked, and they were mainstream. Uh-huh. I started working in books for a few years, and it wasn't until, I mean, Omni was my first short story job, Omni was my first science fiction job, although while I was working at one book publisher for 3 years, Holt Reinhart and Winston, I read some science fiction. I read for Jim Frankel at Dell Books, that's mm-hmm. how I met him. I was like a slush reader for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I read for the Science Fiction Book Club, Book of the Month Club, 20th Century Fox, and I think it was Ace Books, and I read for Ellen Kushner, who was the editorial assistant, I believe, for someone, I'm not sure, at Ace, I think it was. So that's how I didn't initially want to get into science fiction and fantasy and publishing,
mm-hmm.
because early on, there wasn't that much original material being created for books. I mean, most of the stories were... Much of science fiction before the early 70s was serialized in the magazines, which I didn't know existed at the mm-hmm. time. I didn't learn about science fiction magazines existing until a few years before I got to Omni. I uh-huh. didn't even know they existed. So, I mean, I would read short stories anyway, and I read novels, but I didn't realize a lot of them had been published in magazines. But I did know that I didn't want to get pigeonholed in one thing at the time in books. So I didn't want to apply for a science fiction job in book publishing. But anyway, my last job in book publishing was a Crown. And
okay.
then the next job after that was Omni as the associate fiction editor.
Okay.
And so that was my first short story job, my first science fiction job.
So how long did you stay in book publishing then?
I guess it was hard for me to exactly say, but I think I started around 1973 to maybe 74 to 78.
Uh-huh.
And I was in a lot of different publishers, not doing very well. I mean, moving from one to another, and one went out of business. My first job, I was at one job in Little Brown 6 months. I worked for different jobs for a very short time in book publishing until I got to Holt Reinhart and Winston. That's when I worked there. I worked there for 3 years, and that probably was between 75 and 78. And I did a little editing there. And then I guess my job at Crown was only 6 months or so. So it was like I was at five different publishers between like 73 and 78 and only at one place for 3 years.
So all of the upheavals that we're seeing in publishing today are nothing new. It's always been sort of a
Everyone moves. You move to move up. I mean, that's how it always was. I don't know if it's the same way now. I'm assuming it is.
Uh-huh.
But that was always in mainstream. As I said, that was all in mainstream publishing. Although at Holt, I did read some science fiction and fantasy.
Uh-huh.
And I even worked, I think I did some preliminary editing on Jim Morrow's, one of his novels, an
okay.
early novel. But, I mean, that was when I was first learning how to actually edit, you know,
uh-huh.
and I'm not a natural novel editor, but, you know, I mean, and you can't teach editing, so it was kind of like, here, why don't you do this? And I did that, and I don't, you know, I guess I did okay. I don't know what I, know what I was doing. So, I mean, I didn't even really learn how to edit, really. I mean, and the thing is, you can't, and it's not teaching. It's the process of learning on your own, or uh-huh. teaching yourself, and figuring out what works and what doesn't, until I was at Omni, actually.
Uh-huh. And so then how did you get to Omni from Crown?
At Holt Reinhardt and Winston, Don Hutter was the executive editor. He published J.G. Ballard. He published James Morrow. And he published Bob Sheckley. So he knew I was interested in science fiction, which is why he said, do you want to do this on with James Morrow? And he also did a book called The Book of Facts or something with Frank Kendig. Frank Kendig was the first editor of Omni.
Okay.
So even though I had left Holt Reinhardt and Winston and was at Crown, I still hung out with friends from Holt, and Don Hutter said, "Why don't, there's this new magazine, why don't you contact Frank Kendig and see what it's about?" So that's how I got to Omni, from Frank Kendig, who was actually on his way out, but you know, I didn't know that. Omni had a history of, I mean, I worked there 17 years, and that 17 years we had like, I don't know, I'd have to go and count them up, but at least 5 or 6 editors, overall mm-hmm. editors. You know, they did not last more than 2 years because it was hard. You know, the Guccionis were not easy to get along with. And in some level, they wanted control. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got to Omni. And I met with Ben Bova, was the fiction editor mm-hmm. at the time. He's not actually the first fiction editor. I think it was the third. I mean, uh-huh. they had like people before it started. I think one of Alfie Bester's, I'm not sure. I think Alfie Bester's ex-wife was one of the first fiction editors, but she didn't last at all. Uh-huh. I don't even know if she lasted. She bought anything. But Ben Bova was a fiction editor, so I interviewed with him or talked to him. And bless him, it's like, I came out of nowhere. He knew nothing about me. And here I am. I want a job. Will you hire me? Blah, blah, blah. I was like, what? Who are you?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like, I don't know. But he must have known that something was going on. He had a secretary. He did not have an assistant, which means the secretary, she was someone who was not into science fiction, not into editing, so she didn't do any of the flesh reading or anything. She uh-huh. just was a secretary. So I met with him, and I said, please give me a job, please. I mean, I would haunt him. I went in, I don't know how, first I went to Kendig, I think every few weeks, and said, is there anything I can do? Uh-huh. And then I met with Ben, and he said, well, this was during the, I think 1980 was the Brighton World Con. Now, uh-huh. Ben was going to that, and I was going to California. And there was 1 week that I would be there before he got back. And I said, I'll redo Slush Pile for you by the time you get back. I was like this, well, you can't see, but it was a few feet high.
Right.
And I had no reading for him. And I said, I will read your Slush Pile before you get back. And at first, he said, let me think about it. You know. And then he calls it, oh, all right. So I came in the week before he got back. And sure enough, I read his Slush Pile. uh-huh. And then he said, well, hang out. Just keep coming around. I said, what do you mean? I mean, I wasn't getting paid for this. You know, I said, uh-huh. I had nothing else going on anyway, I don't think. I must have been getting unemployment at the time. I said, what do you mean, hang out? He said, well, see if there's anything you do around the office. So here I am, this young, well, not that young, but compared to some people, but relatively young person, coming around saying, you know, do you have anything for me to do? You know, can I? And this is all on nonfiction people. They're, you know, they're the nonfiction editors. And they're like, oh, okay. He must have known that Frank Kendig was going to be laid off, fired, basically, mm-hmm. and that he was going to be made the editor. And so and they were looking for a new editor. And that's when they hired Bob Sheckley.
Uh-huh.
And Bob needed an assistant. And I said, well, I don't want to be an assistant because I'm more experience. I want, and also it's more money. I want to be associate fiction editor, which is slightly higher level. And so I was hired as associate fiction editor for Bob Sheckley, who knew nothing about working in an office. So that's how I got to Omni, basically.
And so when you first started reading that Slush Pile, did you kind of have this feeling of, yeah, this is what I want to do for the next however many decades? Or did that?
I don't think I thought ahead. I uh-huh. didn't think ahead. And it's like, if I thought I was going to read a Slush Pile for the next 25 years, I don't know how I
would
have it.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I don't want to read this for the rest of my life. It didn't come as a, I don't remember coming as a flash, you know? Uh-huh. I mean, I was happy. Once I started actually working there, I was very happy. You know, I mean, uh-huh. it was a perfect job for me.
Uh-huh.
And I learned a lot, you know, I mean, politically, getting along with people, you know, a whole corporation and all the ins and outs. And I was very often, I was usually protected by my boss. I mean, I'm not talking about Sheckley. I mean, once I became fiction editor, the boss is the editor of the magazine from stuff. And, you know, it's like one guy could not believe. He said, "You don't want to be promoted, do you?" I said, "No, I'm happy. I want to be fiction editor. I am doing exactly what I want. Do you think I want your job?"
Yeah.
No, I don't want to be the editor of the magazine. Are you kidding me? No, I'm exactly, you know, and no one can really understand that. Like, don't you want to get ahead? You know, no, I am at the top of where I want to be. Thank you. Leave me alone. So, I mean, I just wanted to be let alone to do my job. And mostly I was a left alone to do my job with occasional exceptions.
Uh-huh.
You know, any kind of big organization where demands are made.
Uh-huh. Well, and so was it during your time at Omni that you began editing the best fantasy and horror, year's best fantasy and horror?
Yes, it was. Let's see. That would have been, I think the first one was 1987 or 86. I think it was 87.
So were you the first ever editor of the year's best?
Well, that particular one.
That particular
I mean, don't forget there's always been a history of them, but that was the first year's best fantasy and horror.
Uh-huh.
There had been year's best fantasy and science fiction, year's best fantasy, year's best science fiction, year's best horror, but there'd never been the combination of fantasy and horror before, and that was Jim Frankel's brainchild.
Okay.
I mean, he's the one who initially was buying it for Blue Jay, but Blue Jay disappeared before it ever, Ars Camera came out. He also started Gardner Dozois, year's best science fiction, and the first book of that, or maybe even two, were Blue Jay books, but then St. Martin's took them over.
Oh, okay. And so, did you, right from the get-go, edit those with Terry Winling, or who was...
Yes, for the first 16 years, Terry and I co-edited them, although, you know, she did the fantasy, I did the horror. Once in a while, we had stories that overlapped, but I didn't go out of my way to read fantasy. I tried not to read fantasy, and she wasn't interested in horror. So, I mean, it really was separate, and we'd get together once a year, maybe, or talk and say, "Oh, I'm taking that, too. Let's share that one." You know, even though I wasn't aware of that, why don't we both put our initials on it? Because I think it's dark, and I think it's both. I think it's fantasy and it's horror. Why don't we both use that? And sometimes we split wordage, which was nice. So we did that for 16 years, and then Terry kind of burned out for a while, and Gavin Grant and Kelly Link started doing the fantasy from number 17 to 21 for 5 years, I guess.
And so how did you initially get into the year's best? Was it because of your interest in the short fiction, or your contacts with writers, or your contacts with the editing community?
Well, Jim approached me. Jim Frankel approached me. Don't forget, I knew him for a long time. I knew him from the mid-70s. Jeez.
Right.
Because I knew him for reading forum, but I also did a few anthologies. My first original anthologies were Blood Is Not Enough and then Alien Sex. Jim knew us. I mean, he knew us because he lived in New York then, too. I mean, he lives in Wisconsin, Madison now, but I mean, all three of us lived in the New York area. So Jim knew us, and I guess he knew what we were both doing. So I'm not sure how he approached me, but I mean, he did. He approached us separately, and we were interested in doing that.
And I remember you and I know each other from Clarion West, of course, and I remember someone asking you how people's stories were put into consideration for the year's best. And you explained that you read every single horror story that was...
Well, I try to.
That was published
I
in a pro market.
You know, I always miss things. But yes, I mean, I try to. You know, I try to look for horror in places where they may not always be found, like some of the mainstream magazines and the mystery magazines, not just, you know, specifically horror venues.
Uh-huh. But so that you always had current subscriptions to all of the horror, pro-horror venues?
Yeah, I have comps to, there are never that many horror magazines, but right now I get comps to Granta, Tin House, Conjunctions. I actually buy a subscription to McSweeney's, but I don't read it that much, but I just like it. Asimov's, I get Alfred Hitchcock, Ellery Queen, Analog, the magazines you would think would have horror and fantasy and everything. Plus, I try to look at the noir series from Akashic.
Uh-huh.
You know, they do Boston Noir, Indian Noir, whatever.
Uh-huh.
I try to look at those, although I'm way behind this year on that. I lost my reader, so I'm having problems. I'm really backed up right now. And always, you know, I always find that I miss things, and that's upsetting to me, but, you know, I'm only human, and it is a the thing is, it's a full-time daily job. I mean, I never can stop. You know, when I'm finished with this volume, I'll be starting the next one.
Well, you say that there aren't that many, but all of those magazines you listed are more than a lot of hobby readers are able to read, and you're doing this on top of
I must have gotten 100 anthologies this year and collections or more. I mean, not all of them are strictly horror, but I have to look, or someone has to look through them and point the horror out to me. I just took a bunch of stuff off. You can see my couch. Can you see my couch? I don't know. You can't. It's too low. All right. Yes. I just cleaned my couch off. All right. I put most of the stuff in my bedroom so I could try to triage and figure out what I actually have to read. So, I mean, my couch was like everything was falling over and it was driving me nuts. So I decided I'm throwing everything from my couch onto my bed, at least for now, so I can pick and see what I have to read, because it's hard to focus when you have too much. So, yeah, I have to sort the books. I mean, it's not just the magazines. It was just magazines that would almost be nothing. I mean, it's the anthologies and all the collections, of stories that have original stories in them. And I've just been, I'm unfortunately said yes too many times last year. So I'm on the jury, on the Stoker jury for collections, which I figured it would just be overlap because I have to read them anyway.
Sure.
But, you know, it's like, And I'm also on the Jackson jury. It's like, why did I do that? Because I don't have a book that's eligible last year. It's eligible, so I figured it would be a good time. So it's just, this year I had to say no to everything. It's like, I overdid it. It's like, this is awful.
So so while you're editing it, Omni, you were at one point, you took on the year's best, and so you started doing all the reading for that. And then you also do
I started doing a few anthologies there, too, but not many. I first started with horror because I wasn't publishing much horror in Omni, and I thought it wouldn't be a conflict of interest. I mean, the one I started, the first two half original anthologies I edited were Blood Is Not Enough, which is a vampirism anthology, and Alien Sex, which is about sex and gender. And I deliberately chose those because the half of the stories that were reprints were stories that I either loved or that were that I loved and read over the years, or that I had to reject for Omni because they were too much horror or they were too sexual. So in a way, I felt I was getting around the stricture of I felt I didn't want to have a conflict of interest editing science fiction. Although, so the science fiction stories in Alien Sex were probably mostly stories that I wouldn't have been able to buy for Omni, or I didn't think I could.
Okay. And then after, was it 13 years at Omni or 17 years?
17.
17 years at Omni. Did you go straight from there to sci fiction?
No, after Omni Online closed around 1996, I don't remember the exact date, my three former Omni colleagues, Rob Kilheffer, Pamela Weintraub, and Kathleen Stein, we started a web company called Event Horizon Productions. And part of that was Event Horizon, the magazine, the webzine that we actually did, that Rob and I produced, that was science fiction, fantasy, horror, with fiction, interviews, columns around Robins, all kinds of stuff. I mean, we just did all kinds of material on there. I mean, basically, it was kind of a prototype for a lot of things that are going on today.
Right.
On the web. But we did that for a year and a half. And we were trying to make a business of it. It was supposed to be like advertising our business. But we ran, I think, two or three EOS cons for our first online conventions.
Oh, okay.
Ran for EOS, which is HarperCollins. I mean, I don't know if EOS still exists. I can't remember. But it was the imprint started by Jennifer Brell.
Sure.
And ran like two or three online conventions for them, which was weird and fun and kind of primitive, figuring out how to do it with several people.
Yeah.
It was interesting. And we also did a lot of, internet chats. And that was when I found out at Event Horizon, well, Omni too, we did internet chats with scientists and also science fiction writers and all kinds of writers. And that's when I discovered how many science fiction writers were Luddites at the time.
That's,
I mean, you know, 1996 or 95, I forget when we actually started the interviews. Some people had to do them on the phone because they couldn't figure out how to do it on a computer.
Right. Well, yeah, you and I are also both on listserv, which there might still be people on dial-up on VSA. I don't know, but I know that well into the 21st century.
Oh, I have a friend who's still on dial-up. Yeah.
And it's funny because it is. It's people who write about this far future and high technology and all of these things. And...
I know. It's like, wait a minute. Come on, guys. You know, you're supposed to be in the future here. And I have to talk. We have to do this on the phone. Someone had to type for them so we could type in their answers. It's like they couldn't get online.
Right.
It was funny. It's funny. But, yeah. And it wasn't that long ago. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
It was 15 years ago, so.
Yeah, but even still, yeah.
Yeah. Well, even my mom's online now, and she checks email.
Yeah. Yeah.
We did that for a year and a half. And then we wound that down. We realized we couldn't afford it. We weren't making enough money to support it and support ourselves, so we wound down. And right around then is when I started working. Right after that, actually, I started working for sci-fi.com. Craig Engler and Sean Redlips had approached me after Omni closed about doing fiction for the Sci-Fi Channel. Well, it was actually called, I forget the name of it. Before sci-fi.com, it was called The Something. I'd have to look it up. I wrote about it in one of my books. The Dominion. It was called The Dominion. It was a website. I don't know who actually started it, but it became sci-fi.com. And they wanted sci-fi.com to become everything for the web. You know, so fiction, audio, plays, animation, all kinds of stuff. And they said, we want, you know, eventually to have a fiction era. I said, great, you know, get back to me when you're ready. A year and a half later, I always put that kind of thing in the back burner, saying, yeah, sure, you know, if it happens, let me know.
Right.
And then a year and a half later, when Event Horizon ended, they came back and said, well, we're ready. You want to do it? I said, you bet. So I think that started in, I started in 2000, and I think we might. I can't remember when we first published. I'd have to look it up, but I did that for about 6 years, almost 6 years, till 2005. So maybe we started in 1999 or so, or I started in 1999. The first issue came out in 2000, possibly. Whenever you're starting a new enterprise, you're working on it several months before the first issue comes out.
Right.
That's how publishing works, basically.
And so this was before Sci-Fi changed their spelling to SYFI and
they changed the spelling after everything was gone except covering Sci-Fi Channel, basically.
Right.
You know, I mean, no, we were sci-fi.com spelled the way you traditionally
would spell Sci-Fi.
That's why I was gone, and then they changed it months later.
And so what was that like working there? Did you find the environment?
It was working for another corporation, you know. Basically, I just wanted to be left alone to do my job, which is what Craig and Sean mostly left me do. It was great. I mean, I've always been very lucky. I've had people who have, quote-unquote, protected me from the vagaries of the executives. You know, I met Guccione, Bob Guccione, once or twice, and he asked me earlier, what's cyberpunk? And I had to tell him what cyberpunk was. But basically, I met him two times. I met Kathy Keaton once or twice, but I didn't have to deal with them because my bosses were good enough to protect me from them. I just want to do my job. I love fiction. I love editing short fiction. Yeah, I do not want to deal with the politics of everything else that's going on if I don't have in a big magazine that's got huge advertising budgets and, you know, huge agendas and national, you know, it's like, I just want to be left alone to do my job.
And so at Sci-Fi Fiction, where it's your job pretty self-contained to edit a fiction area on the site, or was there any sort of vision to have you scout out any kind of talent that might be then brought into?
No, I mean, I was worried. Initially, I thought I did have to do that, and I occasionally, early on, I think I published something, an excerpt or something that was related to a big name, a big franchise that I won't mention. But basically, I think they lost interest. I mean, I think the corporation, I mean, they had the opportunity, I mean, it was a huge, you know, it's connected to a film company, right? They have access in their contracts. They could look, they had like first right of refusal or something for like 30 days or something from when a story was published. So they had hundreds of stories, some supposedly, that I would send, that they should have had someone looking at and say, this could make a good movie. But, as far as I can tell, they basically wasted all that possibility by never doing anything. You know, at one point someone was reading the fiction, but I don't think they made anything or made any move to make anything out of any of them. So, I mean, to me, they wasted a huge opportunity of 6 years worth of short fiction.
you moved on from them when their short fiction department disbanded?
I mean, they basically closed us down. We weren't getting enough page views compared to the rest of the site, mm-hmm. which made sense, you know? Mm-hmm. And they, I mean, we were the last to go of the original content, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was hired, we had a whole bunch of people working on original content, and the Sci-Fi Channel was the little bit of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was only a little bit of what was going on, but there was all this original content, starting with the news department that Craig Engel created, SF, I don't remember what it was called, but that Scott Edelman now runs. Mm-hmm. But that's where it started. I mean, mm-hmm. that was a major part of the site. And then they started adding, you know, they had audio plays that were great, produced by Tony Daniel. I mean, they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. And web comics, you know, they added more and more content. And I guess the final content was actually the fiction.
Okay.
And we lasted longer than the rest. Then they started cutting back and firing everybody. And the fiction was the last of the original content, except for the news.
Okay.
That was kind of the final bit that they were able to protect and keep going for a while.
And all during this time, you were doing the year's best, and then you were also doing other standalone anthologies?
Yeah, I would do some anthologies. I mean, I didn't do that many, you know, I didn't feel the need to. I mean, I didn't need the money to do it. And I was doing enough work. The thing is, working on a weekly website, webzine, is really time and energy, heavy on the time and energy.
Uh-huh.
And I wouldn't want to do that again the way I did it. I mean, uh-huh. It's exhausting. And I didn't have a production person, really. I mean, I didn't have a managing editor who would schedule things, uh-huh. which was difficult because it means I had to keep everything at the tip of my brain uh-huh. to know, oh yeah, I'm going away for 3 weeks or 2 weeks. That means when I get back, I'll have 6 weeks worth of work. Oh, I have to get everything to the copy editor and the proofreader and the art, you know. So it was really hard to do that. But I mean, I loved doing it. I loved editing and everything.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if I'd want to go back to doing that on a regular basis unless I had a really good managing editor
uh-huh.
who's things and cracked the whip and said you have to have this by such and such date.
uh-huh. Well, and so after, in your post sci fiction era, there was a while there when you were making your living from
anthologies. Your anthologies,
and so
and unemployment for the, well severance pay and then unemployment for at least a year.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, from I guess 2007 for like 4 years or 5 years
uh-huh.
doing that,
and then your latest. So
I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, and then your latest job now is as a consultant for Tor.com.
Well, it's not a full-time job, obviously. Uh-huh. It's, it's piecework. Uh-huh. I mean, I love it, you know, I do it, but I mean, I'm not on staff. I don't get insurance.
Uh-huh.
I have regular hours, which is good. I mean, the good thing about it is basically I feel I'm on my own. I can solicit and acquire stories and not have slots to fill.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't have to buy a certain amount of stories. I don't have to have, I mean, I'm not, no one says you have to buy a story by such and such date.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I knew if I wanted, we have a poetry month, April, so uh-huh. I knew that, I figured, I asked, I think they wanted 4 or 5 poems, because I think it's a 5-week month or something,
uh-huh.
and so I was able to commission 2 poems, one from Neil Gaiman, and one from Dora Goss, so that was fun.
Uh-huh.
But I don't have a deadline, you know, you have to buy such and such by this date.
Right.
Right. I mean, the pressure's not on me. I mean, there are other people acquiring. Anne Vandermeer, Liz Gorinsky, and Patrick Nielsen Hayden are all acquiring stories, and occasionally other editors from Tor do.
Okay.
You know, but they're, you know, obviously Liz and Patrick have full-time jobs there, so they may not want to acquire that much short fiction, which is fine with me.
Uh-huh. Well, and so,
and more.
do you have like a regular schedule? Like, would you say that? Could you say what sort of percentage of your time is Tor, and what percentage of your time is anthologies, and what percentage of your time is Year's Best? Or
it's kind of difficult. I'd say 24/7 is your best. I mean, it's, uh-huh. it's my burden. It's my
yeah.
I mean, like, no, it's a time of the year right now. I know this is coming out later, but I'm doing this right now in January. It's my burnout time where I hate the year's best. I never want to do one again.
Uh-huh.
I say, why am I doing this? I'm killing myself, and I'm making half a penny a word, a half a penny an hour for the rest of my life.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I'm going to do it again. I mean, I do it. I love reading great short fiction, and I love getting it into people's hands. So that one takes the most time, and I do it right now. I'm doing it 90% of my time. I'm not getting that many submissions for tour. I don't read the slush pile. I get submissions specifically that I ask for from people and uh-huh. you know, from a few other people. So I'm not getting that many submissions yet, which is good. I mean, I bought 4 stories and 1 poem so far.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, I'm not in a rush to do that. Right now I have 2 stories I have sitting on my my couch with me with the books I have to read for Year's Best. So those are things I have to read.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not spending that much time on the tour.com work. I don't have to.
Right.
I mean, if more manuscripts come in and I buy more, I mean, I can't buy an unlimited amount. You know, I was assigned, you can buy this many right now. And I said, well, what if I want more? I was like, well, we'll see, you know, but right now I am not told I have to buy anything.
Uh-huh.
So that leaves me very free. I'm working on a few anthologies, mostly right now, reprint anthologies. I'm about to start working on Lovecraft's Monsters, which is going to be an all reprint anthology for Tachyon.
Uh-huh.
And The Fearful Symmetry is the Kickstarter I'll start working on. I'll start soliciting. I mean, I have solicited stories. I have to get nagged writers to start writing, and we'll have an open reading period this spring. So I'll be starting to work on Fearful Symmetries. But, you know, it won't take that much work initially,
because uh-huh.
I'll be waiting for stories to come in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, you know, some years I have a lot more work than others. Last year, I think I had a lot. I forget. I mean, 2 years ago, I had a lot of original anthologies coming out at the same uh-huh. time. Well, one was delayed for a year, so I mean, it had already been finished. So it varies year by year. But now that I have, at least I know I'll have fairly steady money coming in from tour.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not a lot, but enough, you know, to keep me going. I don't have to kill myself trying to say, oh, I need to sell these anthologies.
Uh-huh. And so in your career as an editor, are there any authors that you would credit yourself with discovering?
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah? When people ask that.
No, I mean, not really. I mean, uh-huh. the fact of the matter is I've rarely published first stories by anybody.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in Omni, I hardly ever bought the first story by anyone. I would buy the second or third.
Okay,
but
so
I barely bought the first ones because they weren't good enough.
And so
I bought Gibson's second story.
Uh-huh.
I bought his story, Johnny Mnemonic, the same time Terry Carr bought the Gernsback Continuum.
Uh-huh.
So, and though, you know, I don't know which he wrote first, but those were the 2 stories that came second.
Uh-huh.
I could have published Dan Simmons' first story, but I let, instead, I had bought another story by him, and I let Ted Klein publish the one that he bought first so that Ted could win this, I mean, I'm sorry, so Dan could win Twilight Award. But we bought the stories around the same time.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, it was really rare that I've bought anyone's, I mean, hardly ever has I bought someone's first story.
So
I mean, it really is rare.
You tend to work with writers who are already on the radar and have worked their way up through the slush pile.
They may not be on anyone else's radar, but they come onto my radar.
Right.
What's interesting to me, and I have to correct him, I say, it's not true, it's not true. Peter Straub's always saying, oh, you're the one who turned me on to Kelly Link. I said, well, maybe, but she was publishing a lot before me.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I had seen her stories at Omni, and I turned them down. They weren't right for Omni. And then I started buying her for Event Horizon, actually,
uh-huh.
her award-winning stories. And but, you know, I forget what Peter first saw her, but it was one of my anthologies, maybe uh-huh. the best of them. Oh, I mean, there are people whose stories I bought very early on. I did buy Ted Chiang's first story.
Oh, okay.
But Tom Dish told me about it when he was teaching Clarion. It's like, so uh-huh. it's like, what do you mean discover?
Right.
Tom Dish discovered him and sent him to me.
Right.
John Shirley discovered Bill Gibson and sent him on to me, and I bought John and Mnemonic.
Uh-huh.
So it's hard to say. I think I published Stephen Dedman's first story, but not an Omni, in one of my Little Deaths.
Uh-huh.
And that was actually from the slush pile. That was from the Omni slush pile, and Rob Kilhover found it and said, it's not for Omni, but you may want to look at it for the thing you're working on.
Uh-huh.
So I bought it. There are people who I've published very early stories in there. There are people who I published in my year's best last year, who was first. Well, I don't know if they're. I have bought first stories for that, but I didn't know that.
Right.
I bought K.W. Jeter's first story, but I didn't know because he had been writing novels, and I commissioned a story for Omni. I used to commission short shorts for Omni to get in more to get in more stories in this limited space I had. You know, do short shorts under a theme, and KW sent me a story, and I bought it. I don't think I realized till he didn't. I didn't know till ages later that it was his first story.
Okay.
I mean, I assumed he had written stories.
So, in all your years of editing, what would you say is the best part of the job for you? What do you enjoy the most?
Finding out that I'm reading a brilliant story first. You know, in a way, that I'm the first person who has ever seen this fantastic story. And finding new writers, writers who I'm not familiar with, who probably no one else has heard of. And, you know, and pushing them in front of my audience. I mean, that's what's great about the best of the year. That's why I'll never give it up. I mean, last year I published, as I said, people who I had never, well, either I'd never heard of or I'd certainly never bought from them before. Anna Taborska, I had not heard of, although I might have read one of her stories, but it never jumped out at me. But her story last year, I'm sorry, not last year, it would have been 2011 that it was published. But the story that I picked was brilliant, and it's like she came out of nowhere as far as I was concerned. And people like that, you know, so that's always fun when you, when something... Or someone whose story has never made an impression and suddenly they have a big leap in their craft and in everything else, and they suddenly start, you want to publish them. And that's wonderful when you see that. So as an editor, I mean, I have a lot of, most of it's a pleasure.
And that's something for people who feel that editors only publish whom they know should take note of, that it's not actually a closed little...
Yeah, I mean, it is to some extent. I mean, no, I mean, I usually have closed markets for anthologies, especially theme, because the problem is, especially with a theme anthology, if you have an open market and people will send all their stories on, let's say, the subject on Lovecraft, all right, then it means you're going to have hundreds of rejected Lovecraft stories floating around.
Right.
And that kind of dissipates the theme that you're trying to push.
Right.
But yeah, as far as any reprint anthology, I'm totally open, and I do want to, I mean, I you know, if someone's on my radar, that's great, because then I might start asking them for stories for original anthologies. So yeah, it's not, it's never a completely closed shop, and it isn't personal. It really isn't personal. It's I see your story, I love your story, it's great. I don't care who you are, even if I hate your guts, if you write a brilliant story. I may not buy it because I may not want to work with you, but I'll still like your story. And I, you know, if I mean, there are people who I don't want to work with, but if I don't have to edit their stories, I'll take them anyway. You know, if I have to work with someone and I'd find them unpleasant, that's a little different. No, why should I do that?
But speaking of someone who's got only rejection letters from you, yes, it is never personal.
I have been told in the past that I write the nicest rejection letters, so I guess that's a good reputation.
Yeah, and you know, like you say, it's not personal. It really is all about the art and... You know, the quality of the work.
It is someone who, when it's painful, it's really difficult to reject people who you know, who you're friends with. You do it. That's part of the job. Part of the job is rejection. Lot of the job is rejection, because I can only take a certain limited amount of stories for anything, anything I'm working on. That's the only, except for magazines. If you're doing a magazine, a monthly or a weekly, that leaves you way, way open to a lot more submissions and possibilities. When you have an anthology, you know you can only fit, 17 to 20 stories in there. I mean, I've been friends with people for a long time and never bought their stories. I have been friends with people who I didn't buy their stories for 15 years and then I bought a story. I have people who I've bought stories from I've never met. I mean, that's, you know, in the years best, people would criticize sometimes, oh, she's only taking stories by people, you know, friends. It's like, really? I've never met, I can say, I've never met five of these people. I've never heard of three of these people. Like, no. But I, you know, the thing is, when you have friends who are writers, and you really love their work, you know, some, you know, they're going to be reliable, and of course you're going to ask them to produce something if it's for an original story.
Yeah, but it all does come down to the quality of the work. It is not a...
And the thing is, you don't want... I mean, even I have my so-called stable of regulars, but I want new voices, too. I mean, I try to include people I haven't included before in my anthologies when I can.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. Is there anything, any other last words that you want to get in, or?
I don't know. I can't think of anything. Can you think of anything else
you know,
that I missed?
No, I think it's been a brilliant interview, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.